Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A major federal climate report released just last week presents a comprehensive account of how global warming is impacting U.S. communities, including the increased frequency of wildfires. The report, which is mandated by Congress, also projects that climate change will have drastic effects on the American economy, causing a 10% decrease in the GDP by 2100. Today on Forum, we want to discuss the report's many findings, including local health impacts and what can be done to adapt to a changing climate. Joining us here in studio is Kate Gordon. She's senior advisor with the Paulson Institute, co-author of the Fourth National Climate Assessment. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
Glad to have you with us. We also have with us Dr. Helene Margolis. She is associate professor at UC Davis School of Medicine, co-author of the Fourth National Climate Assessments. And welcome, Dr. Margolis.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. And we also want to welcome Kendra Pierre-Lewis. She's climate desk reporter for The New York Times, who's been covering this story. Thank you for joining us, Kendra Pierre-Lewis.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And I should mention that 13 federal agencies were involved in this over 1,600-page report. It's the second volume of National Climate Assessment, and it's been required every 4 years by law. It came to pass under a commission of Bush Senior's administration. Let me begin, Kendra Pierre-Lewis, with you. We were just talking about wildfires, and this report makes it pretty explicit and makes the dots connected as far as wildfires and climate change, does it not?
Yes, it does. It basically says that the wildfires that the West has experienced over the past 20 years or so are pretty strongly correlated with warming temperatures. It also makes the point that wildfires, even though we think of them as a Western phenomena, as the climate warms, are going to also pop up in other locations, such as the Pacific Northwest. So I don't know if you guys remember a lot of the big wildfires they had there about 3 years ago, and also in the Southeast, so places like Tennessee with the Gatlinburg fires. They're no longer just going to be a California thing or a Western thing, unfortunately.
There was a cold snap recently in the Northeast, and President Trump said what happened to global warming with an obvious sense of irony. And he, you may recall, called global warming a hoax made up by the Chinese. Here's a report that pretty much gives, well, shall we say, a wrecking ball to those kind of notions.
Yes, but climate denialism is a thing. It's very prominent with our current administration, but it's actually the minority opinion. Most Americans and pretty much all climate scientists are accepting the fact that climate change is real. It's happening. And more importantly, we often talk about climate change as though it's a thing happening in the future, like it eventually will be something maybe our grandchildren will see. I think one of the largest outcomes from this report is not just that climate change is happening, but that we're already beginning to experience the effects of it.
Let's talk about some of the other big takeaways from this report or findings from it, because there's a lot to unpack here. I mean, it talks about the economy, it talks about trade, agriculture, and so forth. Give us, if you can, what you think are the most central points that are, for those listening, the takeaways.
Sure, especially for Californians who have a really large agricultural economy. One of the big takeaways is that they found that agricultural levels were reduced back to levels in the 1980s. We're just not going to be able to produce as much food. A specific quirk is dairy farmers are going to be directly impacted because it's going to be so warm and dairy cattle don't produce as much milk when it's warm. They're going to have to find other ways of cooling them, or they're simply going to have to move the cows someplace else.
And in terms of the economy, which President Trump said, I don't believe, it's talking about a GDP going down, and it's also talking about some serious economic descent, and I mean descending type of descent.
Right, and it's kind of common sense, right? Like if we're spending a tremendous amount of money fighting wildfires, dealing with hurricanes, that's money that we're not spending in other areas, right? So automatically that's making things less productive. If your farm is every 2 years is being wiped out because of a drought, that's making us less economically productive. So it's not a huge leap for us to recognize that, like, yes, in a warming world, as it disrupts sort of all of the systems that we've depended on to create our economic system, there's going to be a decline in economic production.
And let me go to Dr. Helene Margolis, who, again, is associate professor at UC Davis School of Medicine and co-author of the Fourth National Climate Assessments. Let's talk about generally what is being essentially presupposed as the effect on health in this report. Dr. Margolin?
Thank you. Well, there's an array of exposures that will increase with climate change. among them and most obvious would be increased heat, and not just heat waves and those types of episodes, but long-term average temperatures. During a normal summer, vulnerable populations are at increased risk. So you obviously, if you have higher temperatures over longer periods, you have more people at risk. Increased air pollution, in particular ozone, which is formed, the reactions driven by higher temperatures. And then, of course, the wildfire smoke, which, you know, we've all experienced in a great intensity, hazardous air levels for a couple of weeks. So those exposures are the dominant ones. But coupled with that will be deficits in food potentially, as we've just heard, deficits in quality and quantity of water. One of the other takeaways in terms of potential hazards is that there will be diminished rainfall. So along with warmer temperatures, there's an overall drying tendency, especially in the West. So one of the other concerns is that while there will be an overall drying, especially in California, we're prone to the atmospheric rivers, so there's also potential for greater extreme precipitation events, which is associated with flooding. It also diminishes the ability of our water systems to absorb those extreme amounts of water. So all of that plays into human health, both in terms of the disaster angle of it and extreme exposures, but then also long-term health.
And the most vulnerable are going to be the most affected by this. That's a simple equation. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the vulnerability isn't just, it's, you know, children, elderly, anyone with a chronic disease, such as cardiovascular or even diabetes, those underlying diseases actually increase the risk for these acute events associated with heat or air pollution. And then, of course, the people who are less resilient to the low-income communities, communities of color, those are across the board. And of course, children living in those communities or elderly living in those communities have amplified risk.
Okay, Kate Gordon is here with us in studio. She's senior advisor with the Paulson Institute, co-author of the fourth National Climate Assessment. Kate, we're hearing from the White House that this is extreme kind of projections, that there's uncertainty, that this is excessive. Your thoughts?
I mean, I think that this is just standard risk management. I mean, one thing I think is really good about the climate assessment is it puts all of these issues in terms that are very understandable to anyone doing planning, whether it's private sector or public sector. Essentially, we're saying this is what the projections look like. We're already seeing impacts now. We need to start adjusting to the impacts we see now, and we need to start planning for the future. That should be very familiar, frankly, to a property developer in the White House. President Trump himself, as you may recall, built a seawall or planned a seawall around one of his golf courses in Ireland back in 2014 for this exact reason, looking at climate projections and being thoughtful and thinking, I have a property I'm investing in. I need to make sure that it doesn't fall down or get flooded. I think this is something that he understands. My experience is it's something most people understand, and that talking about it in these very present terms, very local terms, and in terms of individual sectors of the economy gets us past a lot of the politics.
It also maybe speaks volumes here in the Bay Area about getting going on sea level rising and the effect that that's going to have on transportation.
Absolutely.
So you're talking about really a response to this that's just local level and taking the local level and moving it forward in a preventive way, because these are the expectations. These are risks.
Well, one of the really challenging things about the whole issue of climate change, right, is that it's this very global problem. Emissions don't respect local boundaries. It needs a very global solution. But these impacts we're seeing and many of the solutions are at a very local level. So what happens, as you were just hearing, what happens even in the Bay Area in terms of risks is a very different profile than what happens in the Inland Empire, for instance, or up in the northeast part of the state. So we're looking at the need to really focus on those local responses, start incorporating the climate risk projections into planning, and doing it in a way that's coordinated at the state level. I think California has too often address these planning issues in a very, very local way without a sort of sense of integration at the regional or the state level. And to me, this
report... It's almost like we're autonomous.
Exactly. To me, this report really kind of underscores, yes, local control is important, but we need to have a bigger plan.
And a bigger plan would include, particularly on the economic level, infrastructure.
Absolutely. I mean, essentially what I'm seeing here, and I've worked on this for a lot of years, and to me, this is a shift. It's a shift from climate change from an environmental regulatory issue to an economic development issue. Essentially, we need to start thinking about our long-range plans with these numbers in mind. We need our metropolitan transit agencies need these numbers in mind. There is a bill. There's just a report, I think, yesterday coming out from the Air Resources Board on SB 375, which is supposed to actually incorporate the state's climate goals into all of these long-range plans and into the types of infrastructure development we're talking about. ARB came out with a report yesterday saying that isn't happening at the level it needs to be or as fast as it needs to be. And that's one of our big takeaways from the adaptation chapter of the report as well. We need to be doing this faster and we need to be doing it more.
Let's bring you, our listeners, into this. In fact, I want to invite your calls and emails, and you can join us now with thoughts about the federal climate report, finding communities already affected, economic losses to income, all kinds of income to come, but also a lot of concern about disruption of supply chains and production falling. Some of this is really pretty grim, but there are ways out of it and ways that really have to be activist in terms of getting out of it. And we'd like your thoughts and like your observations. And again, you can join us now at our toll-free number. We invite you to do that. The number to call is 866-733-6786. We welcome your call, so feel free to be part of the program. 866-733-6786. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website and posting questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Again, we're talking to Kate Gordon, Senior Advisor of the Paulson Institute, and Dr. Helene Margolis, Associate Professor at the UC Davis School of Medicine, and Kendra Pierre Lewis, who is Climate Desk Reporter with the New York Times. And just before we go to calls and emails, let me go back to you, Kendra Pierre Lewis, and let's just get a sense of not only all of these warnings, but where the report is taking us in terms of what we just touched on, which is the need and the immediate need for action.
Yeah, so the report lays out a bunch of different action steps. But what I think, where I think it's the clearest, essentially, is saying that the science is not uncertain. The uncertainty in sort of where we're going to end up is in human behavior and the steps that we take. And so we do need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We do need to invest in renewable energy. We need to do all of these sort of broad scale things, but also on a lower scale that I think is really important for Californians, because I know that you guys have a housing crisis. One of the things that comes up is when you're hit by a disaster, whether it's a fire or whether it's like a flooding event or something. One of the things that we don't discuss enough about is that there's a marked difference between how people who are homeowners and people who are renters end up dealing with that event. Homeowners insurance covers a lot of things. In certain cases, it'll even, if your home is damaged enough, it'll cover the cost of putting you up in a hotel. Renter's insurance doesn't do that. All it does is cover the contents of your home. And that's assuming you even had renter's insurance in the first place. And often renters are lower income. So we end up in the situation where lower income people are actually getting the least amount of financial aid just because of the way in which we set up the insurance industry.
And let me go back to you for a moment, Kate Gordon. Just we're talking about this report could really be used as a political tool for a legal tool, I should say, against the Trump administration. It provides almost a platform for that, doesn't it?
That's a good question. I think it provides a platform for sure for pushing very, very hard when there's, for instance, an infrastructure bill, which we've been hearing the president talk about for years as a priority.
Hearing about a crossing over both sides.
Exactly. And being comprehensive and being $1 trillion. We cannot go forward with an infrastructure bill in this country that does not include these projections. And I just want to echo what Kendra said. This is not uncertain. I mean, we are doing all kinds of risk planning all the time for things that are much less certain than what we're seeing here. We're planning for cyber terrorism. We're planning for other types of extreme weather events that aren't climate related. This is much more certain than those plans. So it would just be, you know, frankly, it would be a bad fiscal policy to not include that in an infrastructure package. So I think there's a hook in here to really push the administration on that point.
And Dr. Margolis, I want to ask you about something. It's a bit nascent at this point, but there's talk certainly about worse heat waves and temperatures affecting health in so many ways. more flooding, more problems with air as well as water. But also there's been concern that when we get higher temperatures, it affects mental health. It creates more violence and more concern about self-harm. Again, this is early research, but there's certainly a lot indicating.
Yes, and that was one of the really powerful emergent findings in this report. It's an area that in the last 2 years, the numbers of scientific publications that are supporting that right now, it's mostly epidemiologic evidence. It's not totally understood whether it's, you know, socially driven or biologically driven. There's reasons to think it could be biological. But absolutely, we need to incorporate consideration of mental health and not just disaster management mental health, but the wearing down of individuals who, you know, well-meaning citizens who see one disaster after another affecting their communities, plus their immediate exposures.
All right, I'm going to go to our callers. Let me first read a comment from Susan, who says, when most people hear something will occur in 50 to 100 years, their response is, it won't affect me. This information must be disseminated as affecting them and their children in the next 10 to 20 years. We must get people's attention in order to press the government to do something about it now. Let me go to a caller now, and let's go first to you, Kip. Join us. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Michael. Something I've been thinking about for a while. I'm not sure how to implement it. But if people would actually drive the speed limit 55 miles an hour, which hardly anybody does, I live in Sausalito. I can actually see the cars on Highway 101, and they're doing 80. I've seen 85 and more. I mean, they're like people racing each other. And if they just drove 55, they'll burn less gas and ergo put out less pollution. And that's what I'd like to see a movement going.
An important point, and I thank you for it. And brings up another question. If I could go to you on this, Kate Gordon, the coal industry. I mean, a big question, but certainly the report makes pretty clear that coal, something needs to be done, and this is essentially an administration that's continued to try to promote the coal industry.
They have. I mean, it's not working very well, and in large part, actually, not because of climate numbers, but because gas, natural gas, is so cheap and it's displaced coal in major parts of the United States. So has cheap renewables. Renewables have come down so much in price that coal's actually come way, way, way down in terms of U.S. use and U.S. production. We do still export coal to other countries, and developing countries, China and India in particular, still use a huge amount of it. And so that is something, it's where this trade issue you brought up earlier really comes in. We need to be thinking not only about our own local areas and communities and people, but also how are these supply chains working? Where are we exporting? And what are the alternatives in those countries? Frankly, I really don't believe in saying to someone in India, no, don't build a coal plant, even though you don't have any electricity. We need to be talking about actual alternatives that we can really put on the table.
And let me bring more of our callers aboard here. And we go next to you. Jim, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call. So my concern is about the Arctic region, because that's one of the regions that will have a very large impact from climate change. And there are a number of companies in different countries that are hoping to take advantage of that by using the region as shipping when the ice is not a problem in the summer, and also for oil and gas development. So it seems clear that the more shipping and development you have in the region, it's going to make the problem in the Arctic even worse. And I don't see very much opposition to those kinds of activities that companies are planning. So I wanted to see if there is, if your contributors, if your guests have any comments on whether or not there is any action being taken on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the question. Kendra Pierre-Lewis, can I go to you on this? You know anything about the Arctic region, or is there anything in the report that brings it?
A little bit, in terms of, like, there is opposition, so, like, there's talk about opening up the Arctic for, like, mining and extraction, and there is regional opposition to that. I even think Murkowski was sort of opposed to that. I might be wrong.
That's Lisa Murkowski, senator from Alaska.
Yes.
Yeah.
But a lot of what's happening in the Arctic is happening pretty region, like locally. A lot of that deposition is happening. It hasn't trickled down yet. But and also there are like agreements, and so there's between countries about like sort of who can control sort of the larger parts of the Arctic, and so there's concern about whether or not some of that opening up of shipping lanes would violate some of those trade rules that we sort of established over the years. And so it's kind of a hot button issue, but ideally, and the goal would be to not get to a point where the Arctic is so thawed that these become realities.
Well, just thinking about economic exploitation in the Arctic makes me realize that we need a little levity. And Andy Borowitz, who's as close to a comic genius as anyone I know, is saying the Earth is endangered by a new strain of fact-resistant humans. There's one to kind of bottle and think about. Here's another caller, Wyman. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I like to bring up the point of a capitalist approach to the climate change, such as cap and trade. We shouldn't think of fighting climate change as a negative to the economy. It's a global motivation driven by common benefit for the human being, and we can put a there can be a huge industry created as we put values to it. Humans can create huge industries just because they think it's important to their quality of life, like sports, medicine. Those industries didn't exist hundreds of years ago, but they are important to our quality of life, so there's a huge industry. So once we have a regulated industry, then there will be innovation technology developed from those. And then the U.S. should think about how to be a leader in this rather than thinking of it as a cost to what we have as current economy.
All right. I thank you for that comment. Good to hear from you, Wyman. Appreciate your call. And we'll hear from another caller. That's Rob. Rob in Richmond. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. Do your experts, they don't realize, I guess, but there are a whole slew, about half of the climate scientists actually dissent from the alarmism, and they call themselves realists, not deniers. And a bunch of these NASA scientists who dissent hold a conference every year. Nobody knows about this in the regular mainstream liberal media. It's ridiculous. And anyone that wants to know can go. For instance, the Earth has been warming ever since the last little ice age in 1683, and the seas have been rising ever since then by 20 centimeters every year every 100 years, 20 centimeters for hundreds and thousands of years. So there's a video called, for the uninitiated, called The Great Global Warming Swindle. It sounds a little bit right-wing until you get into the science. And the science is fun, Michael. It's fun to I voted for Obama twice. I was a Democrat. I voted for Trump, but so what? The science is actually on the side of the dissenters, because the science is being politicized. And there's Dr. Tim Ball of Canada. There's Nobel Prize winner Dr. Ivar Giaver of Norway. And particularly his 2015 lecture, you can see it on YouTube, Global Warming Revisited.
Now, I've read some of these, what you call realists, and let me get a response from you on this, Kate Gordon.
I feel I am not a climate scientist. I just need to put that out there. I will say, though,
there are a lot of climate scientists who are pretty much on the other side. It's a great majority.
97% of scientists are sort of on the same page as this report, as the IPCC. I will say that on this issue, I tend to go with a Republican who I've worked with a lot, George Shultz, who has been around the block on this issue. And he would say, when he said this when he was working on the Montreal Protocol on the ozone layer, he says today on climate change, even if you don't think all the science is grounded, even if you don't understand the science, shouldn't we take out an insurance policy? We're seeing the impacts now. We're fairly certain about the impacts to come. These things are not far off. We're building things today that have a 40 or 50 year lifespan. Our bond raters are rating those projects. We are putting steel in the ground. Shouldn't we be paying attention to what the majority of scientists say is going to happen when we do that? Because it's just good policy.
And let me thank Rob for his call. And speaking about good policy, in the last segment, we were talking about the difficulty of tensions between the federal government and California in terms of environmental issues, and that has pretty far-reaching effects. I mean, it's not only the federal government is out of the Paris Accords now, but power plants and vehicle tails pipes and all of those things really fit into the picture. Here's a listener who says a 10% decrease in GDP by 2100 seems quite tolerable compared to social collapse. Does this report state the minimum impact of which the scientists have very high confidence or the middle of the bell curve of likely impact? Can you help us here, Kendra Pierre-Lewis?
I'm not sure what they mean by like middle of the bell curve, really.
I think they're talking about the likelihood as opposed to
tail risks.
Well, this is risk management. This
yeah.
Is,
so, to some extent, sorry. The 10% estimate is actually median. So, if you actually pull up the like study that they are pulling from, it can go actually as high as 15% of GDP. So, they actually went with the middle of the road number. They're fairly confident in it. It's not that hard to extrapolate based on existing costs. That we're already beginning to see. Circling back to the social collapse, are they trying to link like taking steps to mitigate climate change with the collapse of our society?
Can't guess that, really, but Kate Gordon, you want to weigh in here?
Just really quickly on this, one of the big findings of the report is that because this is risk management, you can't take these numbers in a vacuum. You can't take this as a snapshot and just go from there and never look at these numbers again. Climate change is something where every time we emit more, the risk probabilities change. So what is today a 1 in 100 year event becomes a 1 in 20 year event. Houston had 3 1 in 500 year floods.
Constant changing,
constant
adaptation,
changing.
And the necessity of all that. And yep. Final word from you, Dr. Margolis. Could you say something about health risks now and perhaps what people ought to especially keep in mind?
Yes. So I think that the health risks need to be managed at all levels, from the individual all the way through communities and governments. We have the capacity to integrate adaptation and mitigation such that general health is promoted, thereby reducing the vulnerability and risk. I don't think we should be hopeless, but I do think we need to be in constant state of positive action and being aware of our risks, both as individuals and as community members.
And unfortunately, keep your masks handy. They may come in handy again. Thank you all. Thank you, Dr. Helene Margolis, Kendra Pierre-Lewis, and Kate Gordon. And thank you, our listeners, for this first hour of Forum. There's another one up ahead. Stay tuned for that and stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.